This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Al Rubin, author of The People's Lawyer.
Al's book is a dynamic history of the Center for Constitutional Rights, how it was able to survive some 50 years, the political and legal struggles that have gone on there, and how it's become and remained a vibrant organization today.
We'll talk about the new book, To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion.
World War I, the Great War, like all wars, fought on illusions and lies. A war that was supposedly end all wars, and a war that was going to be won quickly. Remind you of anything today?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Heidi, I know over the last 10 days I've been reading a lot of stories about murders and shootings that took place in Pennsylvania at a weekend house of what I'm calling the Shea family. Three people were killed and two are still alive after being shot. The circumstances sounded awful. I mean, it was somebody came into the house and just put guns to people and killed them, including a two-year-old. And everybody across the country, the United States, has been appalled by it. I mean, just really completely shocked. I saw it and I didn't think much of it. It looked like some kind of, they said something about a dispute or something, but I couldn't tell. But you came in this morning and you handed me something about who these people were politically and where they lived, and that you actually knew them and certainly knew Monica Shea, who was apparently your neighbor in the East Village. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about these deaths and who the people were, and particularly Monica Shea, who I think is your neighbor.
Michael, in addition to shocking really the conscience of the nation, those from the East Village and from Manhattan in particular were stunned because we knew Monica Shea, we knew her as Catherine, her affectionate nickname. And her husband, Paul, was a local plumber who helped with the squatters and local residents. He did work for the Guild years ago. I knew Monica through the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. She also lived around the corner from me, so I would see her in the neighborhood. We worked on promoting a book called The Stolen Lives, Killed by Law Enforcement, which was a book published in the late 90s by October 22nd Coalition, along with the National Lawyers Guild and the Anthony Baez Foundation. And it had photographs of everyone who'd been killed by police officers in New York over, I think it was like the decade before, but it had a little vignette about each person. And Catherine was just really a committed activist. I also knew her through the Tompkins Square Police Park riot in August 1988. We had homeless people camping out in Tompkins Square Park, and then the police and their higher-ups admitted this was a police riot. They unleashed violence on our community and toward the homeless in the park and the activists who supported them. And Catherine had been very active in standing up for the rights of those homeless people who had been literally living in Tompkins Square Park for months. She was there every day. She was really a beloved person, a committed activist. This is a huge loss for humankind. And we really are hoping that Paul makes a full recovery. And
Paul, her husband, is still alive?
He's alive, and he's in the hospital. If you go by their house, you know, there are flowers, and there was a vigil a few days after the shooting, and then a memorial, because Catherine passed a few days after the actual shooting. So there was a memorial outside Tompkins Square Park.
Some of the best work in the country right now on computers and privacy is done by a group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They've been involved in everything from defending WikiLeaks to others and helping all of us who need computer help. And recently there's a case that they've been involved in on something that I don't really know what it means, but Heidi is our resident expert, an encryption key What is an encryption key and what is this update case about, Heidi?
All right, let's first clarify, Michael, I'm not an expert on computer, but an encryption key basically protects the data on your laptop or home computer so that it affords you a layer of privacy.
Encryption is a form of security that turns information, etc., into unreadable ciphers by applying a set of complex logarithms to the original material. They transfer the data into streams or blocks of seemingly random alphanumeric characters. It can encrypt or decrypt. And, of course, there are several types of encryption schemes, but not all are so secure. Some can be broken, some are very hard to break, etc.
With the rapid increase in technological developments, our case law has not kept up, essentially, with the cyber world. So this case, which started with fraudulent real estate transactions, involves a Colorado court trying to compel a person who's accused of a mortgage scam to either turn over the passphrase or to provide a plain text version of the data held on the laptop. And Electronic Frontier Foundation says this breaches the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination.
If you're forced to give up the key, there might be material they get a hold of that might incriminate you.
And it effectively forces the person to become a witness against herself.
Makes sense to me, Heidi.
Makes sense to us because we are open-minded about privacy issues. I think what's at stake is the fact that computers now are repositories for most of us for literally years of emails between family and friends. It contains our internet browsing histories, financial information.
So what happened in the case?
Electronic Frontier Foundation filed an amicus or friend of the court brief, and this issue was just being reported on, so I thought we should at least mention it and hopefully follow the development.
Well, you know, it's not going well, I think, on protecting your rights with regard to computers. You know, the ACLU has been representing people who have their computers seized as they cross the borders into the United States. And, of course, you know, the argument of the government is you have no Fourth Amendment rights when you cross the border. You may have a Fifth Amendment right, but you have no Fourth Amendment rights.
Against unreasonable search and seizure.
And they can just take your computer and download the whole thing. And the government will then say, well, we'll protect you in terms of if there's attorney-client stuff and other things like that. But so far, in the district court, and in one Ninth Circuit case, they lost on that issue. So you're at great danger.
Well, there's also another thought. You know how some organizations and individuals may do it as well, back up their materials sometimes to an off-site service, so say a server somewhere that may be hosted by a nonprofit organization. And it's dawning on me that also contains the same information, and I'm wondering if the government wanted to, if it could go after that as a sort of third party. Michael, I hear Human Rights Watch just came out with a report on prosecuting our former country leaders.
George Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, John Ashcroft.
And the basis is violating international human rights norms.
Torture, abuse, secret sites, the whole lot of it. It was written, actually, the main part was written by a friend of mine, Reed Brody, who's at Human Rights Watch. We couldn't get Reed on because he's in another place right now that I couldn't reach him by phone. But while the report doesn't really contain much new that a lot of us didn't know, it's an updating of an earlier 2005 report, I think, that Human Rights Watch did on prosecuting people like General Jeffrey Miller from Guantanamo and others. And what Human Rights Watch says, a lot of new information has come out in the last couple of years that they wanted to summarize. The number of 183 waterboardings of some 9/11 conspirators, alleged 9/11 conspirators, etc., and they wanted to summarize it. And the report has actually gotten a fair amount of press on it, including editorials. What Human Rights Watch says is that they say the broad allegations are not new, but they should be given fresh attention because of the growing documentary evidence of classified papers, admissions made in books by the former President Bush and others, and also the leaked International Committee of the Red Cross report that details clearly illegal practices by the former administration. And what Reed says, Reed Brody, it says, quote, it's become abundantly clear that there is no longer any movement on the part of the Obama administration to live up to its responsibilities to investigate these cases when the evidence just keeps piling up. Just this year, we have the different admissions by President Bush that he authorized waterboarding. And then the report goes through the evidence against each of these so-called leaders of our country. And interestingly enough, at the end it says it calls for the international prosecutions that the Center for Constitutional Rights is currently involved in Spain, and says there's no hope in the United States right now. And they laud and say it's a good thing to have these national courts like the ones in Spain go after these high U.S. officials.
Michael, we've covered the boycott, divestment, sanction movement quite a lot on this show, and I know the Guild is part of that movement. What's the update that you have?
What's interesting is that that movement is obviously having a big effect on Israel, because Israel, which, quote, considers itself democratic, has essentially tried in the last week or 10 days to ban the boycott, divestment, sanction movement in Israel.
Meaning ban people coming in who are part of it.
Well, worse than that, it's called the Bill for Prevention of Damage to the State of Israel through Boycott, 2011. And they have a definition section, and then they consider anybody who publishes a public call for a boycott of the State of Israel is committing a civil wrong, and they have to pay damages if they're convicted isn't the right word, but if they're found liable. There's damages based on two things. One is there's just damages as a fine for calling for a boycott of the State of Israel in print. And there's the damages if any contract is broken that you have to pay. So here we're talking about this great so-called bastion of democracy in the Middle East. Israel is now banning calls for a boycott. Look at it. It's obviously disgusting and awful. But what's great about it is it shows that BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction, actually is having a significant effect on Israel. It's one of the best nonviolent strategies you can have for trying to change Israel's occupation and the Israel apartheid system.
One would say that if the leaders of Israel were a little savvier, they would just ignore it because now they're drawing more attention to it with this proposal.
But it is hard, you know, I guess it's getting hard to ignore because it's actually having an effect. Even people within Israel, you know, last year, a number of actors and writers, et cetera, refused to perform in a new theater that was built in the occupied territories.
Right.
So it's actually having a big effect. And as some people have been writing about this, what's remarkable is here Israel says all the Palestinians are violent and they attack us all the time. And now Palestinians and others have come up with a movement that's nonviolent, and the Israelis want to ban it.
Right.
So when you ask yourself, the next time you see, quote, violence on behalf or by the Palestinians, ask yourself where that comes from when you ban means of nonviolent protest like the BDS movement. It's a law that, in my view, pushes Palestinians more into saying, we can't, if we're violent,
we
get
do?
In trouble.
Right.
If we're nonviolent, we get in trouble. But what it really at bottom shows me is that the Israel apartheid system is under serious attack and is weakening and is using, you know, whatever means it thinks it can to try and suppress that movement. But of course, it'll be a total failure. Now, one thing people may not know, and I'm sure don't know on listen to this, is there is actually an anti-boycott law in the United States.
Well, we have the Animal Enterprise and Terrorism Act, which punishes boycotts of corporations.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, that's good. That's
one
I didn't know about.
I call that an anti-boycott law.
That is a,
which
that
one,
is
what
one.
Other one is there?
There's another one. The boycott law in the United States prohibits boycotts against countries when undertaken, it's obviously about Israel, but when undertaken at the request or requirement of a foreign country. And that was originally aimed at when there was many years ago, or maybe 20 years ago or some number, I don't know the whole history, when the Arab countries were boycotting Israel and there were companies in the United States that rather, because they know that Israel is a much smaller market than the rest of the Arab countries, let's say Coca-Cola, I don't know if it was Coca-Cola or whatever, they were refusing to sell to Israel because then they couldn't sell to the Arab countries. And the U.S. passed a law, if a country called on you to boycott and you were basically going along with it, that you couldn't boycott without committing illegality.
I'm curious if that's been enforced.
It probably was back then, or at
right.
least, but right. today, the BDS movement in the United States, of course, isn't doing it pursuant to the call of another country.
Right.
So it's not running afoul of the law. But it is an issue out there. So it's not that Israel is the only one out there. I mean, Israel, they want to protect Israel in every way they can, in Israel and in the United, and at least the U.S. government does.
Right.
So you're getting this anti-BDS. It really just, again, as we end this little update, it just tells me that BDS movement is one of the strongest movements we have for changing the apartheid system in Israel.
Back to another of our favorite subjects, Michael. That would be Obama and secret sites. What's happening on that front?
You know, a big thing under the Bush administration was that they were running illegal, unconstitutional, outside the law, secret torture sites all over the world. When our wonderful President Obama took office, he banned secret sites. I mean, he claimed to ban them. He said you could have like transition sites where you're moving someone to somewhere else, you know, for a few weeks or some short period of time.
You just hold them briefly.
But, well, we don't know how it ever came out, but that was the claim, and that secret sites were banned. And even the Guardian newspaper, when they were talking about Obama recently, they said something to the effect of, well, he did get rid of secret sites. He did ban torture, even though he's not prosecuting people. But now comes along, most amazing reporters, of course, in our country right now, Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, and he writes an important article in The Nation last week about Mogadishu and him getting off the plane in Mogadishu and seeing not just a U.S. secret base right at the airport, a drone base, whatever else, but to seeing a secret prison underneath the Somalian National Security Agency headquarters.
Now, how did he have access, Michael?
Well, I didn't ask Jeremy, but where prisoners suspected of being Shabab members are held underneath. Now, what's interesting about that, okay, so it's Somalia, it's not Obama. But, of course, while Jeremy says it's officially run by the Somalia National Security Agency, U.S. intelligence personnel pay the salaries of the intelligence agents at the NSA, the National Security Agency of Somalia, and directly interrogate the prisoners. And Jeremy even cites the case of a prisoner who was rendered to that prison by Somalia, essentially, I think by Somalia or Kenya, but the U.S. gave all the information about who they wanted rendered to that prison, and then they let someone else do that dirty work. So here you have a secret prison in Somalia, paid for by the United States, at least the agents are, interrogations by the United States, and people rendered to it by information from the United States. If you have any doubt about whether the U.S. is running a secret site in Mogadishu, just hear this. The ICRC of Somalia has confirmed that they have never been notified of nor invited to visit the CIA's black site prison in Mogadishu. ICRC is the Red Cross. Under law, it's required that the Red Cross have access to every prisoner. So much for the assurance of Red Cross access to people all over the world. Bush, Obama, Obama, Bush.
The People's Lawyer by Al Rubin is the first comprehensive history of the Center for Constitutional Rights. It tells the center's story from the civil rights era to today's legal battles on habeas corpus, torture, and Guantanamo Bay Prison. The book reveals innovative tactics that have evolved within the radical organization. Al Rubin points out how the Center for Constitutional Rights continues to fight with the same spirit, audacity, and courage it was founded with. As many listeners may know, CCR has been an important cornerstone to this radio show because our own Michael Ratner has been with the center for 4 decades. One review of The People's Lawyer reads, "If you want to understand how a progressive organization can survive for decades, take on a hostile government, and remain honest to its values, read this book." We're joined today by author and screenwriter Albert Rubin. Welcome, Al, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We thoroughly enjoyed reading The People's Lawyer about the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we wanted to start by talking really about the rather unusual birth, as it were, of the center. Can you describe how the center came to be?
Well, it goes back to the 60s when the founders, who were 4 in number, they were Conoy, Stavis, Kunstler, and Smith. Well, Smith was a Southerner, Ben Smith, and he had an office in New Orleans. And Morton Stavis, William Kunstler, and Arthur Conoy were Northerners who were working for civil rights in the South. They were all working their separate beats, but they, especially the Northerners, knew each other and were in constant communication about the work they were doing. It came to a point where they decided that they needed something to help them, primarily financially, to keep their work going. And so they got in touch with a lawyer in the North they all knew who had a considerable means, financial means, named Robert Bohm. They asked him to come down and look at the work they were doing, and Bob Bohm went down, and Smith was central to the whole project because he had an office in New Orleans, which was very useful to them. They could use it as a headquarters. He was unusual because there weren't many Southern lawyers who were willing to stick their necks out for the cause of civil rights at that time. With the help of Bob Bohm, the four organized something more formal, and they incorporated it in New Jersey, and it became ultimately the Center for Constitutional Rights. It went through a couple of different name changes, but that's what was the beginning of the organization. They had a very small budget at the beginning, and they had a little office with one lawyer in Newark, but that was their beginning, and it obviously grew and became into something that we know today.
Al, I wanted to read just a couple of sentences about how that actually happened. As you said, they were a team. You write, "With Smith threatened with prison and Canoy arguing before the Supreme Court to keep him out, Kuntzler taking on all corners in the Deep South, and Stavis counseling the Mississippi Challenge, it was a heady, if frenzied, time. During this period, as Stavis remembered, he and the other three spoke to each other almost every night from wherever they were. We were a team." And I think that this was one of the most exciting periods for those of us in the Guild and at the Center. There was the challenge to Dombrowski for organizations that were registered as subversive, and that included the National Lawyers Guild, the Southern Conference Educational Fund. And this was really, as you say, these passionate men who were traveling around and realized they needed more of a formal structure.
Mm-hmm. They needed an organization to let them keep doing the work that they were doing. And that structure became the center. They had, particularly Kuntzler, had very little idea that it would become what it became. He thought it was just going to be an ad hoc organization that would last about as long as their work in the South. But he was quite wrong, obviously. Stavis, I think, had a much bigger view of it. He was much more prescient. And Canoy saw it as a real people's movement organization that could organize people's movements. He was very idealistic about it.
Al, one of the things that I found striking, and I know is true from firsthand experience, is that throughout the book, talking about a lot of these cases, especially in the early years, CCR attorneys wrote how they were often, and Nancy Stearns was once, she said, "We were thrown headlong into something above our abilities, but managed by creating theories, and was a tremendous learning experience most other attorneys don't have when they go to traditional law firms." And I think that the learning component, both for young attorneys, but also for the people, and as Arthur would say, sort of being movement lawyers and bringing the issues into the public forum, has been an integral part of CCR since its formation.
I think that's especially true in the case of women's law.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to go there with you next after Heidi's question. But just keep going on that, because that was one reason why the center could survive, because it had some ability to struggle inside and move forward.
Well, I think it was remarkable, because the way it came about, I think, was that there were women on the staff at the center who were both center lawyers as their occupation, but they were also women. And as women, they were caught up in the formation of the women's movement. And they brought the two together. They brought their experience as organizers of the women's movement into the office. And they said to the people they were working with, to Canoy and to Stavis and to Kunstler, hey, there's something going on here. Women are organizing, and they need support as a movement. And they met with some skepticism. These were men, after all, and they didn't recognize the fact that women were becoming a movement.
And this was, of course, the late 60s or really early 70s, when there were very few women in law school, very few women lawyers, and there were no particular legal organizations devoted to the rights of women, abortion or anything else.
That's right. It was the early days of the women's movement, and it wasn't apparent at that time, particularly to men who were of a certain age. So these young women at the center encountered resistance, and they had to fight their way through that. And they did, and they really were instrumental in bringing about the first women's law decisions. They brought abortion cases.
Right, in those cases, I think, and you pointed out in the book, because I think you spoke to Nancy Stearns, who was one of the young lawyers at the time at the center, that up till then, abortion had been looked at as a doctor's right to give the medical practice or medical procedures he or she wanted to as a doctor, and not the woman's right to decide on a choice of whether to deliver a baby or not. This is, I think, the center's lawyers, along with some other National Lawyers Guild lawyers, were the first people to bring the cases that say this is a woman's right and not a doctor's right.
That's right. That's right.
And who should ever think that? I mean, the idea that was had to be thought about even is amazing to me. I mean, but that's the way it was at that moment. I would say if there's a backbone of the book, it's sort of that whole discussion about what's the role of law in civil and criminal. And the center made some mistakes in going forward on that. So why don't you just talk about that a little?
Well, in the earlier days, the founders, I don't think, saw the center primarily as a place for criminal law as such. In the South, they defended people charged with crimes such as the Dombrowski people. Ben Smith was charged and so on. But those were very particular cases of crimes. They were political crimes. But the center didn't see itself as a place that would take on criminal law as such. It was more a movement-centered organization. One way that was manifest was when the Central Park jogger case came along and Kunstler tried to take the appeal, represent the appeal of one of the convicted.
These are people who were accused of raping a white woman in Central Park, five young black men.
That's right. Bill Kunstler wanted to represent the appeal of one of those people convicted, and he wanted to run the case through the center. People in the center took his case under consideration and said, finally, no, we don't want to take that. That's a kind of crime that we don't represent. We don't take that kind of thing. And they refused him, and he went on to do it anyway. And a similar situation arose when Mort Stavis brought the Kelly Michaels appeal to the center. And that was a teacher in New Jersey who was convicted of molesting, child molestation. He wanted to represent her on appeal. And again, he was turned down. And he represented Kelly Michaels without running it through the center, and he was successful in representing her. But the center said, no, that's not the kind of case that we want to touch. Child molestation, we want nothing to do with that. It was an odd thing. They didn't see those were movement-oriented sorts of cases, and that they were not within the the mission statement that represented this, the center.
It's interesting. You know, I don't think I was at the center, Al, when those two cases were decided upon. But even I still today probably would distinguish one from the other. The Central Park jogger case is a black-on-white rape, classic Southern kind of case, even though it took place in Central Park, that the center would have had that been in the South, it would have reminded you of millions of cases in the South and probably would might have had a different opinion about it. Might have. I can't say for sure. But there was a failure, in my view, of the center to put it in that political context.
Mm-hmm.
And it still surprises me in a way. Part of it was, and people differ, and of course you address this in the book, part of it was they weren't experienced criminal lawyers at the center other than people like, Morty and Bill, but of course they were the ones who wanted to take it. But secondly, of course, it was the height in a way of a feminist part of the center, a woman's part of the center, where they just basically said, we're not defending rape cases.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's part of what went on, even though this was a black-on-white rape. And, of course, eventually Yusuf Salaam was vindicated completely in that case. I think you draw it in the book on this. You do. Like you open the book with it. When the Guantanamo cases came down and it looked like there were going to be people taken to Guantanamo, and I think you recite that story, we used the fact that we turned down those two cases, but certainly the Central Park jogger case, as one of the ways of saying, we better not turn down this case.
And I think you yourself were central to that, making that point to the people who had to make the decision whether to accept or turn down the Guantanamo case. I say in the book that politics of the founders were central to their beings. They made their politics guide them in whether a case was something that they should adopt. Pursuing legal goals without having first analyzed the place those goals occupied in a broader social and political context was foreign to their natures. So they had to see that the legal goals coincided with the political situation. When they didn't see that, they had a problem. Shell Oil Company case.
Sarawiwa?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sarawiwa case. It had great educational possibilities. It took 13 years to see that case through the courts, but in those 13 years, the center did a lot of teaching about what oil companies do when they get into cahoots with governments and despoil countries. The center has that function of educating.
Albert Rubin, author of The People's Lawyer, a book about the history of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and not just the history, but much more than that, about political struggles at the Center for Constitutional Rights, their relationship to a broader societal function, and it's subtitled The Center for Constitutional Rights and the Fight for Social Justice, From Civil Rights to Guantanamo. As a person who's been with the center for 40 years, Albert Rubin, I want to really thank you for doing this history of the center. It's an important history, and particularly it was interesting to me, who lived through a lot of these political struggles, to see your take on them and to see how the center resolved a lot of them. So thank you, Al Rubin.
You're very welcome. Thank you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Returning guest Adam Hochschild, historian and author of the new book, To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918. In the book, Hochschild has focused on the anti-war movement in Great Britain. Near the beginning of World War I, 20,000 British men refused the military draft on principle. Others were conscientious objectors, and nearly 6,000 of the men were sent to prison. Hochschild relied on personal letters, diaries, and memoirs to craft this unique historic report on Britain's powerful anti-war movement. The book also unearths how anti-war activists were monitored constantly by civilian and military intelligence as agents provocateur bragged about their accomplishments. To End All Wars is a compelling account of the heroic anti-war struggle, while top writers in that period, such as Rudyard Kipling and H.G. Wells, contributed rhetoric to support the war propaganda. Author and historian Adam Hochschild joins us today. Welcome, Adam, to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you again.
Now, we were talking before you got on. Henry Ford said, "History is bunk." And yet we have a marvelous book from you on history. What motivated you to write this?
Well, Heidi, I always like to think that we can learn something from history. Often it's not a specific policy or a specific thing that, you know, bears an exact resemblance to some issue we're facing today. But sometimes I think we learn to be inspired by people who stuck to their ideals, even in very difficult times. Now, several of the recent books I've written have been about crusades of one sort or another that succeeded. I think the last time I was on this show, I was talking about my book, Bury the Chains, which is about the movement to abolish slavery, which did win. And I thought it would be an interesting challenge to write a book centering around people who I admire tremendously, although they lost the cause that they were struggling for. I've always been fascinated by the First World War, which remade the world for the worse in every conceivable way and killed about 20 million people in the process. And I've been particularly struck by the people who resisted that war on both sides, who said this war is not worth this millions of lives and we're not going to fight. So in part, I wrote To End All Wars to tell their story, or the story of some of them.
Well, let's talk about a couple of these people, Adam. I've been reading the book. It's a delicious book. For all of our listeners, if you want something this summer that's going to just delight you, get Adam's new book, To End All Wars.
I agree. This is the kind of book that when you have all your other work to do, you don't do it because you get involved in the book where you really create character.
There's a number of people that I want to be able to talk to you about, but let's start with Charlotte Despard and John French. Who were they? What's their relationship, and what was their relationship to the war?
Well, I met them in this fashion. I wanted to talk about two different types of people in this book. The generals who fought this terrible war, filled with illusions that always that the next battle would bring a great victory and that the cavalry would charge through the gap and so forth. Fascinated by those people. And then I was also fascinated by these pacifists and war resistors who saw that the war was madness, saw that it was not being fought for any great principle, and who did their best to try to stop it. And one day I was reading a very boringly written scholarly article about a well-known British pacifist, Charlotte Despard, who was an ardent opponent of the war, traveled up and down Britain 1915, 1916, 1917, visiting the families of conscientious objectors in prison, trying to keep their spirits up, spoke out very strongly against the war. Rallies where she spoke were shut down by the police on several occasions or broken up by angry right-wing mobs. Anyway, the author of this article, in one sentence in passing, mentioned said, naturally, Mrs. Despard's activities were deeply distressing to her brother, and it gave his name, Sir John French, which I immediately recognized as the British commander-in-chief on the Western Front for the first year and a half of the war. And I got to know this brother and sister somewhat better as I read their letters and diaries, their letters to each other in some cases, and I was fascinated by them because they had diametrically opposite points of view on absolutely everything. She, for instance, he'd spent his entire career in the British military. She had been an ardent proponent of independence. independence for Ireland, independence for India, votes for women, had been to jail four times before the war, struggling for the rights for women to vote in Britain. But they were personally quite close to each other, quite fond of each other. They stopped speaking to each other only when, in 1918, the British government sent him to Ireland as viceroy to be in charge of suppressing the nationalist revolt against British rule that was breaking out there. She went to Ireland to work for the IRA. At that point, they stopped speaking. And meeting them gave me the idea that one way to talk about this war as a moral issue was to show how it divided families. And so I looked for other divided families, focusing on Britain because that's where the largest anti-war movement was.
I remember the numbers when I read it, that there were 20,000 people who were jailed, I think. Is that right? Yeah.
There were 20,000 men of military age who refused to go into the British Army, which was the largest number of outright refusers in any of the warring countries. And the principal reason, I think, was why the anti-war movement was stronger there than anywhere else, was that Britain itself had not been attacked at the beginning of the war. Germany marched into France and Belgium. You can understand why the French and the Belgians wanted to fight back, but nobody attacked England. And many people felt, you know, this shouldn't be our war. Now, of those 20,000 men, many of them accepted the alternative service that was offered for conscientious objectors. You could drive an ambulance at the front, or you could work in a war industry factory making munitions or something essential to the economy. But as a matter of principle, many men refused that, and more than 6,000 of them went to prison under very harsh conditions.
They weren't even allowed to speak.
Yeah, the British prisons at that time, there was this thing called the rule of silence, where you were not allowed to speak to other prisoners or to the guards unless a guard spoke to you. And this was the largest number of people up to that point in time, ever imprisoned for political reasons in a Western democracy.
When I looked at this book, I said, look, I remember seeing, we actually saw movies about the Great War, the First World War, when we were in school. Only two things that I recall. One was, of course, the killing of Ferdinand in Sarajevo, who was going to take over the Austro-Hungarian Empire eventually from his uncle. And I remember these two big blocks fighting. You know, they came on the map of the movie, which was, you know, the English and the French against the Germans and the Empire and, I guess, the Ottoman Empire. And what's wrong with my picture? I mean, it looked like the really good guys against the really bad guys. And that's the way we were taught the war. And so then when the Second World War happened, whatever we thought of the Treaty of Versailles, it was sort of a continuation of the First War against Germany. Is there something wrong with the picture that I have?
Well, I think it's not entirely a good guys versus bad guys picture, as wars seldom are. It's true that I think aggression by Germany and Austria-Hungary did really ignite the war. You know, the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary at Sarajevo was an event remarkably like the relationship between that and the start of the war was remarkably like the relationship between the September 11th attacks and Bush's making war in Iraq.
Now, that's interesting.
That's a good parallel.
Yeah, good parallel, yeah.
The September 11th attack, which Iraq had nothing to do with, gave Bush the excuse to make this war that he had long been hankering to have. Same thing with Austria-Hungary, which had long been wanting to go to war against Serbia, which was right next door, and whose existence the Austro-Hungarians regarded as a threat because they had a lot of ethnic Serbs within their own borders. And it was one of them who killed the Archduke inside Austria-Hungary. There's no evidence that the government of Serbia knew about this assassination conspiracy. Nonetheless, for the Austro-Hungarians, this was the perfect excuse they needed to make war on Serbia. Germany, for different reasons, had been hankering for a war against Russia. They had tremendous racial feelings about Slavs and so forth. And it was really those two countries who I think were directly responsible for fighting the war. But you can't really say it was a war of good guys against bad guys because, of course, the Allies were, at the beginning, Britain and France principally, allied with Russia, which was the last remaining absolute monarchy in Europe. And so for the British and French to claim that they were fighting for democracy, which they immediately did was ludicrous.
Well, particularly since the British had been running an empire, and some of the characters that helped run it are sketched so brilliantly in your book, Adam. To End All Wars is his latest book, a really excellent book, and we urge people to read it. Adam, let me ask you about another divided family that you write about so beautifully, the Pankhurst family.
Right. This was a fascinating case for me. The Pankhursts were leaders. Emmeline Pankhurst, the mother, and two of her daughters, Christabel and Sylvia, they were leaders of the most militant faction of British suffrage activists. People fighting for the right for women to vote. This was before 1914 in England. All three of them had been to jail many times, gone on hunger strikes in prison and so forth. Emmeline Pankhurst, the mother, had been arrested on the eve of the war for literally throwing a rock through the window of 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence. And she was, when the first shots of the war were fired, she was a fugitive from British justice hiding out in France. However, she and her oldest daughter, Christabel, immediately ceased all their political activity, returned to London, put themselves at the service of the British government, which was delighted to have this great troublemaker quieted. And they dispatched both Emmeline and her daughter, Christabel, on missions for the government throughout the war, sent them on speaking tours of England, speaking tours of the United States, sent Emmeline on a speaking tour to Russia at one point when they were worried about the Russian morale flagging. Meanwhile, the other daughter, Sylvia, became one of Britain's most outspoken opponents of the war, published the most widely read anti-war periodical, did everything she could to speak out in favor of stopping the fighting. And she and her mother essentially stopped speaking to each other for the rest of their lives at that point.
Remarkable.
That'll do it. There was a show trial that you write about that reminded me of the great show trial that the government launched against the anti-war movement here in America, the Chicago 8 trial, and the Lloyd George murder plot trial in England in 1917 was another great show trial. And I wanted you to tell our audience a little bit about that and the family that was involved.
That's right. It was an extraordinary case, and one that some of your listeners might be familiar with if they've read the wonderful trilogy of novels by the British novelist Pat Barker about the war. The middle novel of the trilogy, The Eye and the Door, is based on this case. And here's what happened. The government was out to make an example of people in the anti-war movement. They were very worried about these 20,000 men who refused to go to the army. They were afraid that pacifism was going to spread to the army, that more people were going to go underground to dodge the draft. And they went after a family in the town of Derby that was well known for its radicalism and for hiding and helping draft dodgers, the Wealdon family. Lower middle class family. Alice Wealdon was separated from her husband, and she made her living by selling old clothes out of the front room of her house. And she had two daughters who were school teachers, and a son who was himself underground trying to avoid the draft. The government infiltrated secret agents into their household, these guys pretending that they themselves were fleeing the draft. And then they arrested the whole family and charged them most preposterously with plotting to assassinate the prime minister.
Tell how they were going to do this.
Well, allegedly, one of these secret agents testified they had planned to procure poison and to put it on a poison dart and to shoot the dart through a blowgun at the prime minister, Lloyd George. You know, almost all historians today regard this as a total sham, that nothing of the sort was concocted. But during wartime, when emotions are raised, you know, people are eager for a victim, somebody to prosecute and show that the government is being tough. So the country's attorney general himself was the prosecutor at the trial. They rushed it into court right away. It lasted less than a week, ended up on a Saturday, which was very unusual. Session on a Saturday. It lasted about 10 hours. The judge sent the jury out of the room right then and said, "We want a verdict now," and, you know, practically begged the jury to find the defendants guilty, which they did, and they were sent to prison. But the trial left a kind of uncomfortable feeling because everybody, including, I think, the Prime Minister himself, realized that an injustice had been done, and whatever this family was guilty of was not an assassination plot. And then he became very worried, Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, that Alice Wheeldon, in whose defense many people rallied, not all of them radicals, some of them just people who felt there'd been a miscarriage of justice here, he got very worried that she was going to die in prison because she went on a hunger strike. And 9 months after her arrest, he released her from prison, which is not something you do with somebody who you think was really plotting to assassinate you.
Now, Adam, when we began the question of the importance of the Great War, the First World War, you said something intriguing. You said that the results were, I don't want to misquote you, but were just a disaster, or going forward it was, what happened as a result was terrible. And, obviously, I know about the numbers of 20 million killed, but I think you were also addressing the world we got afterwards. And my question, the war destroyed the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It destroyed the Ottoman Empire. Those weren't necessarily the worst things that ever happened. They may have been replaced by some bad actors. They also led to the end of the Russian Empire and the Russian czars, and put in, at least for a while, what looked like what might go in a very important revolutionary direction, whatever we want to argue about with that. But so its effects were to destroy an old order that probably needed destruction.
There's certainly many parts of it that did need destruction. There's no doubt about that. I mean, Russia was certainly overdue for enormous changes and couldn't have lasted far into the 20th century as an absolute monarchy. Nonetheless, almost any other kind of change in Russia that one could possibly imagine, I think, would have been better than the change that did happen, which was an enormously destructive civil war, which caused far greater loss of life in Russia, actually, than the First World War did within that country. And then a regime which, by the 1930s was devouring its own under Stalinism in a way that I think the country is still struggling to break free of. And I say that even though, I think had I been alive in 1917, I would, like so many people did at that time, have greeted the Russian Revolution with enormous hope. It's quite poignant to see, to read the accounts of how war resistors in prison in Britain and the United States, were thrilled when the Russian Revolution happened.
Yeah, and that photograph that you reproduce of the in March when the beginning of the Russian Revolution occurred, and the Russian soldiers fraternizing with the German on the Eastern Front. I mean, really, the March Revolution, I look at it as like the greatest anti-war movement of it all, because it eventually stopped the First World War.
Yeah, well, it certainly stopped it on the Eastern Front. It didn't stop it on the Western Front, because, of course, those German soldiers who were so happily fraternizing with the Russians were then shipped to France and Belgium for the huge German attack there in 1918.
You write about the Battle of Passchendaele, where 260,000 men were killed or wounded in July of 1917. Just extraordinary.
I know. An enormous death toll in these battles. But just going back to the world that resulted afterwards, I guess I'm thinking more than anything else of the way the First World War made the Second World War almost certain.
Because of the treaty, I think we should talk about that for a bit.
I think, the treaty is what traditionally gets blamed, and there's no question that the Treaty of Versailles was something very vindictive, which Hitler used to great effect to build his movement in Germany. But I think there was also something about the way that the war ended that helped lay the groundwork for bitterness and the rise of the Nazis in Germany, too, which was this. Right up to the very last minute, the German people were fed a diet of totally triumphant propaganda. And indeed, in June of 1918, 5 months before the armistice, German troops had been almost at the gates of Paris. And then suddenly, it appeared to the German people, November 1918, there's an armistice, which turns out to be, in effect, a German surrender. even though at that moment German troops and the troops of their allies, the Austro-Hungarians, were almost entirely on enemy territory. So the public had no idea that this defeat was coming. It took them by surprise, and that also, in addition to the Versailles Treaty, enabled Hitler so brilliantly to blame everything on this coalition of pacifists and communists and Jews who had stabbed the army in the back when it was about to win a victory.
We're speaking with Adam Hochschild, author of To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion in the Great War, 1914 to 1918. One of the lessons I think that you get is people thought this war would be over quickly, or as you said on the show, they thought with every big major push they'd get through the lines and end the war. And I'm interested in that question and what lessons we might learn today from Afghanistan to Libya.
Well, you know, I think that illusion is always there. There are several illusions with which so many wars begin. One of them is the illusion that the war is going to solve more problems than it causes. So that's not been the case with Afghanistan and Iraq. Another illusion is that it'll be over quickly. You remember George Bush landing on the aircraft carrier in 2003 with the big sign, you know, mission accomplished. Well, it was the same thing in 1914. The German plan for capturing Paris called for Paris to fall on the 42nd day of the offensive. They had it all worked out of just how many miles the army was going to advance each day. And when his troops set off in early August, Kaiser Wilhelm II told them, "You will be home before the leaves fall from the trees." And of course, it didn't work out that way. And wars seldom do, no matter what the justifications or motives are with which they begin. And I think that's a lesson that we still need to pay attention to today.
Well, that's why I think, Adam Hochschild, people should read your book, To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918, because the First World War, which you write so brilliantly about, really initiated an era of war and civil war and revolution that we're still into today. And if people want to get a feel for the personalities involved in this great, great tragedy, they should read To End All Wars. So we thank you, Adam, very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Michael.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.